coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A land bank created 2 years ago to address blighted and abandoned properties in Wilmington is beginning to make progress. We get an update on the Wilmington Neighborhood Conservancy Land Bank. And NASA is spending time researching how life in space affects astronauts' bones.
We've had further confirmation of the idea that weight-bearing exercise is good for the skeleton. There is still a lack of awareness of vitamin D levels and how that can affect not only bone health, but all types of healing.
Science reporter Katie Pikus explains how that research could also help people here on Earth. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also hear about a group of sketch artists in the First Eight that's banded together in our latest arts playlist. And learn about a new business incubator in Kent County. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. It's been 2 years since legislation was passed creating the Wilmington Neighborhood Conservancy Land Bank. But only now is it really getting down to the business of building its inventory of blighted and abandoned city properties and looking for buyers who are eager to transform blocks, even neighborhoods, that have fallen on hard times. And the land bank is getting a much-needed financial boost from Barclaycard U.S. in the form of a new $1 million grant that will be used to continue its mission of acquiring properties and maintaining them until new owners are found. We asked contributor Larry Nagengast to take a look at where the Wilmington Neighborhood Conservancy Land Bank stands right now and where it's headed. His piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he sat down with me this week to tell us more about what he found.
Remind us why people felt the need to create this Wilmington Land Bank and its specific mission.
Okay, well, the land bank has been talked about in Wilmington for about 5 years. I first heard of it in a conversation about that long ago with people over at Cornerstone West, which is the redevelopment arm of the West End Neighborhood House, which has been active in a lot of the redevelopment revitalization activities on Wilmington's west side. Of course, abandoned property has long been a problem in Wilmington. The foreclosure crisis added to that pressure. If you go almost anywhere in the city, you can see groups of vacant buildings or lots, and you can't do much with them because they've all got different owners. And then on top of that, the city has admitted that it hasn't been doing a great job overseeing all the abandoned property that's under its jurisdiction. So how's the land bank a solution? Well, the idea is to put all the vacant properties under the control of a single entity, which could then either sell them individually or package larger blocks of properties to sell to a developer or to repurpose them for a use that benefits the neighborhood.
And this is not necessarily an innovative idea per se. It's been used in a lot of other places, right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. In the United States, land banks have been around since 1971. The first one was in St. Louis. Now, if you go back to the 1950s, 1960s, factories were leaving our cities. City residents were flocking to the suburbs, and that left a void. There were these run-down industrial and commercial districts, deteriorating residential neighborhoods. And to some, land banks were seen as a possible solution. But the idea didn't really take hold until the housing bubble burst and the foreclosure crisis followed 9 years ago.
So exactly how do these land banks work, or at least how will the one here in Wilmington work?
In Wilmington's instance, most of the properties in the city's real estate inventory are being transferred to the land bank at no cost to the land bank. The properties the city acquires in the future through foreclosures and sheriff sales will also go to the land bank. The land bank maintains these properties while it figures out what's the best thing to do with them next. Maybe it's demolition. Maybe it's a sale to an individual buyer. Maybe adjoining properties are packaged and transferred to a nonprofit developer like Habitat for Humanity. Or maybe the land might best be used for a park or to meet some other community need. Now, and of course, when these lands are sold to one of these other entities, that money goes back into the land bank's coffers.
So what type of homes does Wilmington's land bank generally have in its inventory? And beyond that, who are generally the buyers?
Well, as you might expect, most of them are going to be old row homes. Most often, they've been in neighborhoods where there's been some sort of a disconnect in the real estate market. They're not in places where you would go and put up a for sale sign and get a buyer within a week or two. Now, some of these houses are small and have two bedrooms. Some are larger ones. They've got four. But pretty much all of them do need a lot of work. It doesn't mean that they're falling apart, but they do need a lot of work. And because these homes need some work, and maybe this is going to cost $100,000 even to get them up to snuff and, you know, looking good in the way a buyer would want, the land bank is trying to sell them for bargain prices, $2,000 to $5,000 in most cases. And they're also going to provide some hand-holding to the buyers as they find the contractors to do all this necessary rehab work. Now, they're still working out all of those details. That's a month or two away. But buyers are going to have to take care of any of the rehab work within a year, and if they don't do it, they risk having to give their property back to the land bank.
So what has the land bank accomplished so far since being created 2 years ago? It is about, to take a big step forward, as you just alluded to actually going out there and selling properties to buyers.
Well, it's been mostly working in the background for 2 years. The General Assembly passed legislation permitting the creation of land banks in Delaware in the spring of 2015. The Wilmington City Council authorized creation of the Wilmington Land Bank towards the end of 2015. It took most of 2016 to appoint a board and to have the board secure nonprofit status, write its bylaws, and do all those organizational sort of things. Then in February, the board hired an executive director, Christian Willauer, who used to be the director of Cornerstone West at the West End Neighborhood House. And she has spent most of the last 8 months pulling these basic pieces together. Raising money, getting insurance, developing a system for managing the properties, figuring out how this operation is going to work on a day-to-day basis.
Clearly, funding is a big piece of this puzzle. And on that front, as we mentioned at the beginning of this segment, that there is some good news for the land bank recently in the form of $1 million grant from Barclaycard U.S. How big a deal is this funding for allowing this land bank to really kind of take off and prosper?
Well, without exaggeration, it's a really big deal. The land bank has received a little bit more than $2 million from the city and from the state combined. So the grant from Barclaycard amounts to about one-third of its cash on hand. It's also the largest grant that Barclaycard has ever made in Delaware. So that tells you that they think the project is important and that the need is great. More significantly, Wilmington Mayor Mike Przycki notes that Wilmington hasn't been doing a great job over the years with abandoned properties. So this grant isn't based on anyone's past performance. Rather, it's based on the hope and the expectation that this new nonprofit entity can do a better job than the city was doing in getting these abandoned properties and vacant blighted properties into a better use, more productive use.
And there is a hope, I guess, that money will follow money, that this grant will maybe be just the first of others who might be willing to invest in this initiative.
Well, that's true. The land bank did have one other grant, I think it was like $40,000 from Capital One. But Jocelyn Stewart, who's the community reinvestment officer at Barclay and is also on the board of governors of the land bank, is really hopeful that this $1 million that Barclay has put up is going to serve as an inspiration, a motivation, a catalyst to other financial institutions, to other businesses who have a stake in the city, to put up some money to add a little bit more punch and power to this project.
You mentioned that the city's track record in this area has not been especially great. So how is the city benefiting from having the land bank do this work rather than trying to do it themselves?
Well, it takes the property management burden off the city. It relieves two departments, the real estate and housing department and the licensing and inspections departments, of responsibilities that were time-consuming and that were not particularly rewarding. So now that means that these two offices can presumably do a better job at the other things that they're responsible for doing. And in the long run, this procedure is also going to save the city some money because they don't have to sink their own costs in the future into boarding up properties, mowing the lawn, and all that sort of stuff.
And the expectation is that the city would also benefit in some other ways as well, not just by specifically dealing with these abandoned properties, but also what rehabbing these areas might mean for the city in other ways.
Well, absolutely. I mean, in the long run, instead of rundown properties on which taxes aren't being paid or were being paid late, you're going to have homes that are occupied by their owners who will be paying taxes and who will be caring for their neighborhoods. Getting rid of abandoned properties means fewer calls for fire, for police, for code enforcement officers. And I think, you know, beyond that, you know, there's an economic development issue here as well. I mean, you do the math, the city's got 1,400 abandoned properties, 140 of them are supposed to go over to the land bank. You take 140 properties and spend $100,000 on each of them in the next year or so, that's $14 million that's being pumped into the community for contractors, for, you know, for retailers that are selling home improvement equipment and refrigerators and ovens and dishwashers and all that stuff. So, you know, there's a big economic boost there. And of course, that means people are going to be put to work as well. So there's a lot that can go on here economically that the land bank can stimulate by getting these downtrodden properties into better hands, into the hands of people who, you know, who really want to make them work.
And we've heard from more than one entity. I know the county has talked a lot about it as well, that taking care of these type of properties can really have an impact on crime as well. Is that something also that the city is hoping that it may have some impact as well?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and it's well known that vacant properties are crime magnets. And so if you remove the number of vacant properties in a neighborhood, you're very likely to remove the amount of crime that's going on there as well. You're going to have people watching. So another definitely a positive there.
So how has this worked elsewhere? Do we have any sense of what it would look like in a city that's at least maybe somewhat comparable to a Wilmington?
Well, I guess the one, well, let me just say, you know, there are about 200 of these nationwide. Some of the cities that have created land banks are Philadelphia, Chicago, New York City, Indianapolis, Greensboro, North Carolina. The list goes on. And in most of these instances, Christian Willauer tells me, there were neighborhoods that were in decline and they've been turned around. The property values are increasing. Buyers are coming into these neighborhoods now. There's more interest in them, and the communities as a whole are improving. Looking for an example, Jocelyn Stewart at Barclay Card points to Syracuse, New York. Now, Syracuse is about twice the size of Wilmington, but again, it's an industrial city that has somewhat fallen on hard times over the last 50, 60 years. They created a land bank earlier in this decade. It's been in operation and actually accepting properties and reselling them for about 5 years. In that time, it has acquired 1,425 properties. It has sold 495 of them. It has demolished another 185. And in the process of this, it has generated for the city annually $884,000 in increased additional property taxes. Tax figures and rates vary considerably from city to city, but you know, certainly that's a substantial amount of money for a city like Syracuse, and you can certainly expect that Wilmington should benefit as well.
And this is clearly a long game type of solution. It is something that requires maybe a little bit more patience and time than other things when you talk about economic development and some of these other benefits that hopefully will come out of this land bank.
Well, no, you're absolutely right about that. As I said, 1,400 abandoned properties in the city, 140 of them going over to the land bank by the end of this year. Christian Willauer expects that the inventory on a rolling basis as the operation starts going is going to be in the neighborhood of 300 properties a year. So, so even to take care of everything that the city has now and to turn that over, you're talking about a five-year plan, and that doesn't even include new properties that are going to come into the inventory. So, yeah, it is a long-term process, but you know, if you can make this work, the prospects are very, very, very great. There's reason to be, I'm not sure if optimistic is the best word, but there's certainly reason to be hopeful that some of Wilmington's housing issues can be resolved through the land bank.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. Again, his piece on the Wilmington Neighborhood Conservancy Land Bank is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And next up on The Green, science reporter Katie Pikus tells us how NASA research into the impact space has on astronauts' bones may actually help people back here on Earth. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Working in a microgravity environment allows astronauts to grow about 3% taller. But extended time in weightlessness can also accelerate bone loss, causing astronauts to lose bone mass at about the same rate as a postmenopausal woman. A NASA scientist has been studying this rapid bone deterioration and thinks her findings on what's experienced in space can be used here on Earth, as well as potential future missions to Mars. And Delaware Public Media science reporter Katie Pikus tells us researchers in Delaware are specifically looking at how her research could help prevent broken bones and improve bone health.
The average adult human has 206 bones in their body. Those bones are constantly breaking down and regenerating. This cycle poses a problem for astronauts because in microgravity, bones break down, but they don't regenerate.
So what we're seeing is some kind of form of what we call osteoporosis in our astronauts. The insides of the bones start to weaken because the minerals are kind of lost. They also lose a lot of calcium from their bones, and it goes into their urine, and they are prone to increased kidney stone risk as well.
Dr. Tara Rutley is an associate program scientist for the International Space Station. She says part of the reason for that bone loss is astronauts float around a lot on the space station. So Rutley tells them to exercise for about 2.5 hours each day. They walk or run on a treadmill. They also work out on a machine that helps them do weightlifting exercises like squats and deadlifts in microgravity.
Absolutely no load is on their body until they get on that treadmill and they're loaded down, strapped down to the treadmill, or they get on their resistive exercise device and start doing their exercise.
Scientists test astronauts' bones, blood, and urine over about a 6-month period, including before launch, while they're in flight, and when they return home. Based on all that testing, they figured out astronauts need about 800 IUs of vitamin D per day to maintain their bone mass. That's about the same dose many Earthbound people over the age of 70 take. Here on Earth, we lose bone mass too, but much more slowly. And it's because a lot of us aren't getting enough exercise or calcium in our diet. And the older we get, the more fragile our bones become, putting us at a higher risk of falling and fracturing them. This is where NASA's research on astronauts' bone loss can help on Earth.
But you haven't had any falls, really?
I haven't had any falls in quite a while.
Okay. And are you still receiving outpatient therapy?
Yeah, twice a week.
Twice a week, okay.
Peter B. Kaplan is a 79-year-old photographer from Hokesson. He once climbed the antenna of the World Trade Center, but now he struggles to keep his balance on flat surfaces. He has peripheral neuropathy, a condition that causes him to lose balance. He's receiving treatment at Christiana Care's Safe Steps program. About a week ago, two doctors watched him walk across a room at Wilmington Hospital to understand why he's been falling.
Okay. Think you're ready? Okay. Now you can use your arms wherever you feel most comfortable and natural. You go to walk up to Dr. Guest, walk around her, and come on back at your own safe, comfortable speed, and sit back down. And let's go ahead.
Doctors want to help him now before the problem gets worse and he breaks a bone.
The worst part is I got to remember when I walk, I got to, you know, really spread my legs. And
right.
Walk with this distance.
Exactly.
In between. Because I tend to
keep your feet close together. So when they're farther apart, your balance is much better.
Yeah.
Right? That's what they're teaching you in therapy.
Yeah.
Good.
So Peter is taking a lot of precautions, and doctors say that's a good thing. Dr. Brian Gallinat is an orthopedic surgeon at Christiana Care Health System. He says bones are pretty much use them or lose them. Without enough calcium in your diet, your bones become more brittle, and you risk breaking them.
The simple things that everybody can do is proper exercise, diet, and vitamin D. These are things that people forget about, and you end up finding out you have a problem when you break a bone. You don't want to do that.
Sound familiar? Well, NASA has found the same thing. Whether a person is in space or on Earth, they need exercise and vitamin D to build strong bones. Gallinat says since microgravity has allowed NASA to study bone health at a faster pace, it's helped Christiana Care researchers make improvements to medicine and their bone health programs more quickly.
We've had further confirmation of the idea that weight-bearing exercise is good for the skeleton. There is still a lack of awareness of vitamin D levels and how that can affect not only bone health, but all types of healing.
And as NASA continues to research bone health in space to help their astronauts get to Mars one day, Gallinat says he's looking forward to future findings. Those findings could help patients with weaker bones here in Delaware take one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, without falling. Katie Pikus, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Katie. And stay with us. We have a double dose of arts playlist this week, including a chance to get to know more about a group of sketch artists that's growing here in the First State. But first, a look at your local headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In September 2016, a group of local artists got together and created an informal sketching group, meeting once a month and alternating locations among Delaware's three counties. Now those same local artists have become an official chapter of International Urban Sketchers. Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele for this week's Arts Playlist sat down with one of Urban Sketchers' co-administrators, Rosemary Connolly, to find out what the Urban Sketchers are all about.
We're going to go back a little ways. What happened in September of 2016 when a group of local artists got together?
Well, I even prior to that, I'd been reaching out on Facebook because I am an individual member of this organization called Urban Sketchers. I have been sketching for many years and had become aware of this international group of people that do what I do, and that is to sketch on location. And so I had reached out on Facebook to friends and just said, hey, if I wanted to form a chapter, would anybody be interested? And I got a really great response. So we actually had our very first gathering in September of last year and just said, let's meet somewhere in the middle of the state, kind of. And so we chose Dover, and we put it out on Facebook that we were going to have this, what they call sketch crawls, and it was going to be in Dover. And we had about a dozen people show up to our very first event. And
I love it. Sketch crawls. Yeah. What happens during a sketch crawl?
Well, a sketch crawl is an event, and it usually has a limited number amount of time. We keep it to about 3 hours, which is about enough time to get out there. So what we do is we set a location. Say we were on the green in Dover for our first meeting, and people can sketch. They can sit right there and do a sketch, and then they might move over, you know, down the block to another location, but staying within that area. But they can move from area, you know, from spot to spot, and which is kind of what I do. I generally do two or three sketches during the course of that 3 hours.
And Rosemary, just to clarify, you're sketching what is around you?
Yes, exactly. It's capturing the world around you, and it's capturing it in sketches and also in noting, you know, the place, the time of day. It's observing the world around you and capturing it in drawings and in words. And it might be as simple as, you know, Dover on the green and the date, or you might write more about it. I'm sitting here, I hear the sound of birds, there's traffic, you know, someone stopped to look over my shoulder. Just trying to sort of capture a whole memory in that moment that you were there sketching.
Talk to me about some, I'm looking at the list, but talk to our listeners about some of your past sketch crawl locations.
Oh, okay. Because we're a small state, we go up and down. So we alternate between Newcastle County, Kent County, and Sussex County so that we can attract people who may not want to go you know, all the way from Wilmington down to Bethany Beach. But we do have some who do come. Wherever we go, they come. But so we have been in Leipzig. We've been in Old Newcastle. We've been at the Air Mobility Museum in Dover. We've been at the antique store in Milford, Delaware, at the Milford Museum, down in Rehoboth, right on the boardwalk. So the locations are really varied. We try to find interesting places where there would be a variety of opportunities to sketch. Plus, we always try to determine if there's parking. Our events are free, so we try not to go to places where there would be a fee. And yet, some of the locations, like the museums, have allowed us to come without paying a fee, which is really wonderful, and we appreciate very much. So, what was the rest of your question?
No, I was going to say, so as an artist, what makes Delaware, in your opinion, because it could vary with other people, in your opinion, what makes Delaware so sketchable?
Well, you know what? In my opinion, everything is sketchable. But Delaware has, it has the variety of the charming small towns, the beaches, the landscape, the old barns and historic places are always of interest. So as I say, for me, I can sketch anywhere and find something interesting. People who sketch, you learn to see things that normally people don't even notice. And so so everything is up for grabs. I mean, I've sketched my toothpaste and toothbrush before. So, for me, everything is sketchable.
What is your most favorite thing that you have sketched over the years?
Oh, gosh. That's
come on, pick one. Pick one.
You know what? I have sketched at Abbott's Mill probably more than any other place, just because I love that location.
Beautiful place.
Yeah, it's a lovely place. So of all the places that I visited in Delaware, that's close to home. It's a lovely place to walk, but it also affords you nature and some old buildings, and it's just a really interesting place to go.
All right, so now that we have the background about urban sketchers, how you got started, what it's all about, you guys have received kind of an international designation now. What's that all about?
Well, we are now what's called an official chapter. So the great thing about being a chapter is you're recognized sort of all over the world. And people who are traveling that sketch, will go online and say, wow, I'm going to go to Rehoboth Beach. I wonder if there's a chapter there. And so, they can reach out to us and come and sketch with us. And it's sort of part of something larger than just a group of people who go out and sketch together.
How many other chapters are there?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know the answer to that question. It's probably on their website, but they're literally all over the world, in Europe, in Asia, Africa. They're everywhere. And it's such an exciting thing for me because I think, and it appeals to people at all ages and men, women. It's just such a fun thing to do. And it's because I think in this world where everything is computer, it's all high tech, to have something that all you need is a little sketchbook and a pen, literally, and you can go out and have this experience that it just enriches your life. It just makes you see the world just a more intimate way.
I was going to say, you guys have a very interesting website, so I want you to give that to our listeners. Also, you have a Facebook page.
Yes, that's part of being a chapter, is to have that Facebook presence, so that our members can. We actually have a Facebook page and we have a group page. And on the group page is where other people, members and other people who are part of Urban Sketchers Delaware can post their images, the things that they have maybe sketched on their own, or, with us together. So it's a place where we can communicate with the world.
Let's give people the Facebook or the website address where they can go and read more about your group.
Okay. Well, the international group is just urbansketchers.org, and our page is, if they just look for Urban Sketchers Delaware. That's the page. And then the group page just has a little group in parentheses, and that's the group page. So if they just look for Urban Sketchers Delaware on Facebook, they'll find us.
Okay. And then let's tell people where the next Urban Sketchers Delaware's next sketch crawl will be taking place.
The next sketch crawl is going to be November 2nd. We always meet on the second Sunday of every month from noon to 3. And this November is going to be in lovely downtown, historic downtown Smyrna. And we will meet in front of the Lemon Leaf Cafe that is right there in Smyrna. But we have so many historic buildings there to sketch, and there's the wonderful restored Opera House and other, just really beautiful buildings. So lots of opportunity for sketching.
All right, Rosemary Connolly from Urban Sketchers. Am I leaving anything else out that our listeners need to know?
Gosh, well, as I said, it's completely free. Anyone can come out and sketch. You don't have to be a professional artist. We have anywhere from beginners to lifelong sketchers. So they shouldn't be intimidated if they're new to the world of sketching, but have the interest in trying, they should at least come out and check us out. It's a lot of fun, and it's just really a great activity to take part in.
Thanks to Urban Sketchers co-administrator Rosemary Connolly for joining our Kelly Steele on this week's Arts Playlist. Kelly also took time recently to check in with Delaware Choral Arts as it unveiled its 2017-2018 season. Having brought a rich palette of diverse choral music to the Wilmington region for more than 33 years, Delaware Choral Arts opens its new season Saturday, November 18th, with Mendelssohn's epic two-act oratorio, Elijah. And Kelly recently sat down with Delaware Choral Arts conductor David Christopher to talk about the new season and get some background about Delaware Choral Arts.
David, if you could tell me a little bit about the background of the Delaware Choral Arts, that would be great.
Okay. The Delaware Choral Arts, which was known for many years as Delaware Valley Chorale, was formed actually by me in 1984. I was only 10 years old then. And no, I'm kidding. But it was in my, when I was starting out, I formed Delaware Valley Chorale. And I was with them for a number of years, I think 4 years. And then I ended up I moved to New York, and I got involved in music in different ways. But the chorus continued. Mary Woodman C. Green took it over, and she had it for about 10 years. And she really built the chorus up to a very, she had 70, 80 people in it at times. After she retired, Chick Walker from Princeton took it over, and he retired, and I remember them coming to me and saying, "Wouldn't you like to take your old chorus back?" So we did an interview, and I have been back since 2005. And the chorus was always designed to perform great choral works here in Wilmington, and most of the singers are volunteer singers. Some of them are very trained. They have a music degrees and that sort of thing, and some are just doing it as a hobby.
Are they all local people?
The membership draws from New Jersey, Chester County, Middletown. So it draws from a fairly wide circle. So it's sort of local. It's in this general area. And we perform with the assistance of paid section leaders and a few ringers that we bring in, just so that we can assure the quality of the performance.
What kind of feedback, if you will, David, have you gotten over the years? We're going to talk about this is your 33rd season in just a second, but what kind of feedback have you gotten?
Well, we've gotten, I don't think we've ever gotten a bad review. A lot of times we've gotten no review. So, we've had every once in a while we'll get, someone will come and review and publish, and it's usually a rave, some kind of rave,
Let's talk about your 33rd season at Delaware Choral Arts. Lots to talk about there. Talk to me about some of the performances this year.
The first concert is one of the most famous choral works since like 1845-ish when it was written, Elijah by Mendelssohn. Yeah, in the oratorio premiered at this at the Birmingham Festival in 1845, and it was really well received. It was very popular at the time, and it's gone through phases throughout the year. It's years. It's sort of people have said, "Oh, it has such a Victorian perspective," and it kind of does. But the story of Elijah is very. It's a very powerful, colorful story from the Book of Kings, and the Mendelssohn of I mean, the music of Mendelssohn is, some people would say, exquisitely pretty. You know, it's just gorgeous music, and it can be very dramatic at times. So that combination has kept it as one of the favorites. Also being Old Testament, Mendelssohn's interesting in that, you know, he was Jewish, and then he converted to Catholicism. You know, I'm not an expert on that, but I think it was for political reasons.
Thanks to Delaware Choral Arts conductor David Christopher for joining Kelly Steele on our arts playlist this week. Tickets for Elijah, Saturday, November 18th, are $25 for adults, $20 for seniors and students, and $15 for children under 14. All of Delaware Choral Arts performances are at the Episcopal Church of Saints Andrew and Matthew in Wilmington. For a complete schedule for the coming season, log on to DelawareChoralArts.org. And we wrap up The Green in just a moment with this week's Enlighten Me and a look at an effort to bring a new business incubator and collaborative workspace to Kent County. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In recent years, we've seen business incubators and collaborative workspaces in Wilmington and elsewhere in Newcastle County. Now there's a new business incubator in Dover, providing cheap rent and educational business workshops. The Kent County Department of Economic Development is renting out 2,000 square feet of office space in the Levy Court Complex for next to nothing, provided the renter is using the space to start a new business. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino sits down with Kent County Economic Development Director James Waddington to discuss how alleviating new entrepreneurs of the burdensome high cost of renting commercial space can make all the difference.
It's about 2,000 square feet of office space in the Kent County Levy Court building on Bay Road. It originally housed our Parks and Recreation Department, and when they built the new recreational facility in conjunction with the Boys and Girls Club, those offices moved down to that facility. And so we took a look at this Class A office space and said, what can we use it for? And it seemed like an appropriate usage would be functioning as the Kent County Emerging Enterprise Development Center. And the thought was that a lot of sole proprietorships or entrepreneurial businesses, often one of the biggest hurdles to sort of getting their business up and running is location costs. And the feeling was that if we could provide an incubator space at a reduced location cost, that people could really focus on their primary interest, which is starting the business, not necessarily developing a piece of property somewhere.
So it is very expensive to rent commercial space and probably a big deterrent for a lot of people trying to start a business. How do you cut down the costs?
We're not really we're not here to rent real estate. We're not, the county doesn't need the revenue off of this space. However, it is Class A space. It's currently furnished. We currently do a lot of other business development activities in the Levy Court building. We host the Kent County Open for Business the first Thursday of every month. My office is in this building. I get a fair amount of foot traffic from people that are looking for locations or sites or trying to start a business. We've put together a partnership with the SBDC, and they're doing consulting in this incubator space now. They're also conducting their How to Start a Business workshop on the fourth Friday of every month, and I'm working with DSU to provide additional entrepreneurial assistance classes throughout the year. So we hope to make this like a center of activity for entrepreneurs who are trying to start their business and move on into, you know, our goal is to get them out of here in a year and they go out and rent real space somewhere at a real rate.
And the SBDC, that's the University of Delaware's Small Business Development Center. What is their specific role? And talk a little bit about more about that partnership.
Well, we have a memorandum of agreement that was executed between Kent County Levy Court and the SBDC. And in that memorandum of agreement, we agree to have them conduct their workshop here monthly and also to provide consulting services to folks using our innovation centers or our incubator. So they schedule their appointments to meet with people to help develop business plans and that type of thing.
If someone's looking to start a business and they come to your office space and they rent a space, what are they looking at? What are the options for rentals?
Well, the options are there are four different levels. For $75 a month, they can have what we call a share space where they might stop in once a week, for instance, and do their book work or their paperwork. And then we have the next step up is $125 a month, and that provides you with a shared desk space, which you can use pretty much full time. And the next step up is $175 a month, and that provides you with a professional space where you're you have your own lock-in cabinet, and you have 24/7 access. You have a membership to the chamber. And so it's more like almost like a full-time office potential. And then we have the semi-private space, which is $225 a month, which is a separate cubicle and all those other options. So we do provide Wi-Fi. We have a cleanup crew that cleans the space. We have security on site during business hours. And we provide mail service. Which are all functions that we offer to the rest of the county offices. So it's sort of easy for us to do that.
Talk a little bit more about how important this is and how you are cutting out a huge step for people who are looking to start a small business and how this can often be a deterrent, the process of renting commercial space.
Well, yeah, I will, Nick. And it's not just renting commercial space. Very often we will run into people who say, well, I want to start a business and I haven't done a business plan yet, but I did buy this piece of property, which needs a lot of work, or I want to buy a piece of property and I need X number of dollars in order to do it. That's sort of an insurmountable hurdle sometimes, because someone wants to start a business, and I don't know, pick something out, a tech business, and they need a space to do their work and to do their sales and to meet with clients. But they go out and they obligate for, $1,500 a month or $2,000 a month on a 2-year lease, and they're responsible for leasehold improvements. But they haven't even done their business plan yet. That kind of puts them behind the eight ball in terms of cash flow. So what we're urging people to do is come meet with your consultants, develop your business plan, get your license. Our selection committee will interview you. And if you meet sort of all those criteria, the criteria being that you've developed a business plan and that you have your business license and you've obviously thought it through and you have your financing in place, then we are willing to rent you a space. We do a 1-year lease. We ask that you participate in our classes. And the goal is that you go out and find commercial space, after the first year. Now, we will renew a lease in certain circumstances, but we're not doing this as a real estate deal. We're really doing it to try to help startup businesses.
And how long has Delaware's Small Business Development Center been in action? How long has this project already been underway?
Well, it took a couple months to develop. It was actually formally approved by Levy Court about a month ago. And so it was great that it was approved, but then you kind of have to make the public aware of it. So we've printed up brochures. We've gotten a copy machine in there. We've gotten the Wi-Fi installed. We put up the appropriate firewalls so that it doesn't cross-contaminate with the county's IT system. And now we're ready to start leasing space. We've already interviewed three different parties that are interested. We haven't entered into any leases yet.
Thanks to Kent County Economic Development Director James Waddington and our Nick Shalino for enlightening us this week about the new Kent County Emerging Enterprise Development Center. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Katie Pikus, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.